Welcome to Dark Blue Woods, the Twin Peaks podcast. Hello, this is Ethan and...
This is Nick.
And joining us this week is...
Violet Luca.
Thank you for joining us, Violet. On today's or tonight's show, we'll be discussing our six. I personally don't really like calling them episodes. And when we talk about this particular hour, you'll realize why. But this episode is the succinct Don't Die. And, I mean, we're officially a third to the 18 hours, so I think we could say we've maybe exited Act 1 territory. Who's really to say? But before we really discuss this particular episode, Violet, could you talk about what you've thought of the return so far and maybe just your relationship with the films of David Lynch and the show in general?
Sure. Well, first of all, leading up to this, a lot of people would ask me, you know, are you excited for it? Are you afraid for the new Twin Peaks? And I was just trying to not even think about how it would be realized. And I have to say, this has just far exceeded my expectations in every way. Like, previously my favorite hour of television was the series finale of Twin Peaks, where it's just the utter madness and, you know, seeing Wyndham Earle being killed in like 2 minutes because he was the worst character ever. And just like seeing how angry David Lynch was and just, you know, how madcap that last episode was, and also very dark and kind of sad but just like harrowing. And then just seeing that sort of, I feel like that episode is probably the sort of the dominant aesthetic of this series. You know, I really have been, you know, the third episode, which is just like a beautiful extension of the worlds he creates in his paintings, and then also Inland Empire. It's just been totally a complete and utter pleasure to watch it. I've watched all the episodes twice. Like, I'm really into it. And I would say just generally, I'm all about David Lynch, any medium he's working in, from music to painting to sculpture to the furniture, films, TV. I'm total Lynch stan. I will make all the excuses for him.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we have another avid fan joining us tonight. But, I mean, it's really hard to get the ball rolling here, because what do you really pluck out of this episode? But I thought, at least for me, maybe something for the start to talk about was we get the reappearance of beloved fan favorite Carl Rodd, as played by Harry Dean Stanton. And I think the first thing I just noticed, again, rewatching the episode and thinking about it, was how we get another extended sequence early in the episode of Cooper, or Dougie, we should say, in seeming real time making crude pencil marks on a number of insurance claims, all set to Johnny Jewel's Windswept. And obviously this show so far has had many number kind of patient extended sequences, but I thought there was something sort of interesting about old man time, I'd consider, in terms of seeing how that mirrored one of the scenes with Harry Dean Stanton early in the episode, or midway through, where he's just sitting on a bench in a park, kind of sucking on a cigarette, taking some sips from coffee, and looking at the beauty of the wind through the trees, really.
Yeah, I mean, he's very clearly a Lynch proxy, right? Where he's talking about, like, you know, I've smoked every day for 75 years, you know, fucking love it. Like that like, just, he just does not like that. Harry Dean Stanton character is great, first of all, but I feel like that the slowness of that, and like just the obviously David Lynch practitioner of TM, Just the taking the time to appreciate the natural world, the beauty of the natural world, and also the beauty, like the extension of that beauty and like that simplicity of seeing like a mother play with her child. And I feel like this episode, especially taken with, you know, like in concert with the rest of the episodes, just the focus on children really struck me. And just that, you know, like the so much of the original series was about the sadness of, you know, the like terrible things happening and being powerless to stop them, right? And this is this episode, and usually that was located on a female body. So it's Laura Palmer, it's Maddie, it's you know in the first part of this new series, it was the redheaded like crony of Bad Cooper, right? But now it's sort of shifting like that like the innocence and like that sadness is being shifted to children because there's like the son of the addict who lives in this like abandoned starter home in Vegas. There's, you know, the death of Sheriff Truman's son who could, you know, and then there's the kid who gets run over in this episode and just like lingering on that tragedy and just showing like, yeah, this is horrible. Like violence is horrible and like nothing anyone could, and there was no good reason for it to happen. There's no good reason why that kid of the addict should have to suffer. And yet it happens and we can't, and no one can stop it. No one, and what, you know, it's just like really driving that home in a way that I feel like sometimes got lost in the original series.
Yeah, well, watching that sequence again, too, what I really noticed is how it's sort of representational of a lot of how grief is present in the show, and that there's obviously the witnesses to the event, but they're all sort of just bystanders who kind of stand back and kind of gawk and put their hands over their mouths and hold their significant other. But Carl is the actual only one to step through all of that and show any compassion, probably the oldest man in America.
Well, yeah, it is. With Harry Dean Stanton, more and more watching him, there is a degree to which I wonder if he's really acting any longer, where he comes on screen and he looks, sounds, and moves the way an old man, a very, very old man, does. And just kind of the pleasure he takes in saying certain lines feels so natural that there's sort of this invisible line now between Harry Dean Stanton, the figure who you think of, and the characters who he's playing. Just like the pleasure he takes in saying, "I've been smoking every day for 75 goddamn years," is so palpable. And there was a certain kind of, there's a certain tension in that sequence where he is sitting there looking. I like what you say, Violet, about taking in the natural world, and yet in the background you can hear this Richard Horne character just barreling down the street. And watching it, I was asking myself, is he going to be killed here? Is he actually going to be struck into by the vehicle or something along those lines? And that contrast between just the sound off in the distance and him kind of staring up at the trees, all these POV shots, felt like, again, Ethan, as you said, sort of this thing of old man time, of being an old man. Perhaps that goes back to my spacious comparison to the later films of Manuel de Oliveira with the new episodes. But I was sort of thinking of Oliveira in those moments, actually. Granted, Oliveira has never had a direct shot of a child being struck by a vehicle that's going at something like, you know, 80 miles an hour, but it's okay if the comparison's end there. And that shot itself is so strange because there was a part of me that almost found it a little comic, I have to be honest. I think because the sequence itself, it's exactly the kind of thing you don't think is going to happen. Watching it, you think to yourself, oh, the mother's going to pull him away or he's going to swerve out. You know, he's going to swerve on the road. But instead, what do we get? We get him struck dead. And it is interesting how even now the show can still surprise me in that way, in its brutality, where you sort of think, oh, I've kind of seen everything with regards to what Lynch is willing to do. And then you get to a sequence such as that, which, has no real I suppose there's no real kind of comfort in it, except perhaps the very strange image of some kind of lights emerging from his body and floating off somewhere, while there's the sound of electricity, which, in as we've seen in Twin Peaks, is sort of this, and no pun intended, current between one world and the next.
I think there's kind of little bits here and there that would give up people what they want, but overall I felt this is the first sequence we're talking about. How I remember when we initially were discussing the series, how I thought it might be, or we thought it might be Fire Walk With Me, the series. This was actually kind of the episode, in general, overall downbeat it was, that actually gave me that vibe the most, despite kind of the more surreal touches of the first two or three, I should say.
Yeah, this sort of felt like a more classic version of what Twin Peaks was, where it's very little time is given to quote-unquote the mystery, and most of the time is spent with the townspeople in a way that, you know, is not immediately apparent why you're spending time with them. And is there even necessarily a point to any of this? And I would say the point is exactly what, you know, he's doing, which is, you know, sort of taking it in, looking up and staring and seeing the movement of the trees and seeing how all these things, you know, just observing. And you know, the act of observing, I think, is ultimately the point. And I don't think that, you know, you necessarily have to sort of be, you know, analyzing for clues as to, you know, well, what does this or that mean? But I don't read the recaps. I even hate seeing like fucking memes of Twin Peaks. Like, it makes me very upset. I'm just like, oh God, just let me enjoy this thing without, you know, putting like Bebe over it or something.
For our previous guest, Keith Helix recaps, though, very good. I'll just say
that. Yes, they are.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
The one recap you need to read.
Yes, exactly. All of the recaps bow down. What Keith had to say about the previous episode was, like, very illuminating and wonderful. So, yeah. Well, everyone but Keith.
And maybe possible future guests. Who knows? There was a cliffhanger two episodes of ago, of course, when we heard, I know where she drinks. Everyone saying, okay, we're going to get another character. Because it cut right after that, Albert saying that to the Bang Bang Bar. So we assumed Albert and Gorn would be heading back to Twin Peaks and getting in touch with a classic character, maybe a new character. And, of course, when they announced that big cast list, for example, when Michael Cera was on that list, I think a lot of people accurately predicted he would be Andy and Lucy's son. And here we get kind of another casting guess that I think most people got right, which is Laura Dern as Diane. Though I will say, because I thought this show has been subverting expectations, I actually had this theory that she was going to be a recast Annie, but I guess that didn't pan out.
Right. Well, here's a question for the both of you. I found that sequence felt kind of flat for me, but I don't know how much it's the fault of Lynch, Frost, Ferrer, Dern at all, so much as it is kind of the inevitability of it, where, as you said, Ethan, pretty much as soon as Laura Dern was cast, the response was, oh, well, she'll probably be playing Diane. And I don't quite know what fueled that. I honestly suspect that it was just sort of a residual Blue Velvet nostalgia that we all feel, where we think about it and, oh, how great would it be to see Dern and McLaughlin on screen together again? Nevertheless, there persisted this suspicion that she's going to play Diane, and then pretty much as soon as the shot of Ferrer, right before it cuts to the back of her head, I thought, oh, it's going to be Laura Dern as Diane. And then it was Laura Dern as Diane. And I there was one moment where I was maybe a little annoyed with the discourse surrounding the show, let's say. I mean, as Violet kind of alluded to, you know, you kind of don't want to read too much about it because there's little point in really other people elucidating it for you, which is a very good thing to say on a podcast devoted to talking about the show, of course. And and yeah, I don't know. I was sort of, when she turned around, it was Laura Dern. I went, it wasn't so much, oh, yes, how wonderful it was. Well, I mean, I always say, oh, wonderful when Laura Dern shows up. But in addition to that, I thought, ah, yes, it is Laura Dern as Diane. I don't know if either of you had a similar response to it in that way.
I was just excited. I was just excited because, again, I tried to go into this as innocently as possible. And I yelled when he said Diane. And then I yelled again when it was Laura Dern. So I'm just excited to see where it goes, because, again, I don't think it's going, you know, even if you could be like, oh, it's very predictable that it, you know, Lynch would cast Laura Dern and then put her in this role. It's, I'm sure whatever happens with it is going to be very exciting. So I'm just excited to see where I'm going to be taken.
I will at least say that I would not have predicted she would have that particular haircut.
It's a great haircut.
It was very surprising. Yeah.
What did you make of the her watering hole, Max Vaughn's? What is the surname that comes after Vaughn?
Oh, huh. Do you think that's an illusion?
I mean, it has to be.
Perhaps. I don't know.
It could just be an average Los Angeles watering hole for executive types.
But if they're in D.C., though, right?
Were they? Oh, I just think it was shot in Los Angeles, so I assumed it was there.
No, I know. But I mean, like, I feel like that was... I mean, how could it not be an illusion? Because, I mean, obviously, so much of the original show, like the names from the original show were sort of whacked out references to, you know, Harry S. Truman, blah, blah, blah. But, like, why not, you know, Max von Sydow, Max von...
Oh.
In the blank, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm fully willing to indulge in the idea. It is a nice idea, definitely.
Well, I mean, something that's maybe become a little, I try not to read too many recaps again, other than previous guest Keith's, but I get the feeling some people are getting a little tired of the whole Dougie thing and they want him to snap out of it. The thing I'll say beyond just defending it as, I think, very funny, partly due to, obviously, McLaughlin's performance, I think that even when Dougie, you know, as the one-armed man Philip Jarte says, wakes up, he's not necessarily going to be the old Cooper. Like, reason would he have to be the upbeat, you know, intelligent guy? He's been, you know, out of it for 25 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, what would that space do to you mentally? Like, the little bit of him in... So, obviously, like, he's in the Black Lodge, and you see him sort of lucidly responding, or, like, responding in a way that Cooper might respond to, you know, the giant, to the one-armed man. And then he gets, you know, and when he's on, you know, that magical lavender planet, you know, and he's also sort of responding the way that you would expect, you know, a well-trained FBI agent to do. However, you know, he's suffered a trauma, you know, he's been pulled through this light socket, and it's like, the fact that, you know, when he looks at Sonny Jim and he cries, it's almost as if there's a part of him that realizes so much of his life has passed him by, and he has no sort of, and he can never get it back almost. But then also it's still within this like dream half lucid state of, you know, someone who has undergone like trauma. So it's not coherent. It's not emotions are very rarely coherent, but like, it's like, incoherent in a way that like, or it's truthfully incoherent in a way that like David Lynch conveys emotion. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I would say so. I, for my own part, I was surprised to see a bit of pushback against the Dougie stuff, because I still feel that I could watch 18 hours of that, because I am just enjoying it immensely. And I think that there are finding all these new things to do with it, in part because it is about somebody who is essentially, you know, severely brain damaged, getting their faculties about them. So even just the sequence of him drawing kind of has this sense of an entire world opening up to you. And not to mention that there seems to be very little limit to how much they can milk it, comedically speaking. I mean, even something that's sort of familiar, I think, has kind of a new quality to it in this episode. For instance, it was kind of nice to see him back in the black suit, mm-hmm. I thought. You know, I've enjoyed the big, overgrown lime green jacket, but seeing him back in the black suit, which is the Cooper outfit, albeit in the Dougie state of mind, kind of made me think about the character in a new way. You even have a very similar set of shots from the previous episode, which is the assistant with all the coffee, him in the elevator. But it feels, I think, genuinely different when he's dressed like his old self. And then you also have, you know, there was one little sequence in this that I think kind of drove home the Jacques Tati comparisons that people have been making with him in the office, which is when he's sort of stumbling forward a bit and his boss calls his name really angrily and he just kind of turns around and makes this shocked face, which on the one hand is Tati-esque. There's also something slightly Chaplin-esque about it, I think. And it's fascinating to see Kyle MacLachlan become almost a great silent comedic actor. And yeah, again, the whole corporate parody, I think, is being brought to this increasingly absurd place. I mean, just, you know, it's hard to talk about it in totally serious terms because I just find it so deeply funny. But the boss, whose name unfortunately I can't remember, but he has some ridiculous name on the boxing poster, says, you know, he's just looking over and finally says, "This is very good work, but I'm very disturbed by it. You must not tell anyone." And then one of my favorite shots actually in the entire series so far, it's kind of this three-layered shot of him sort of having swerved around with his handshake, the boss with his hand extended looking confused, and in the background, the boxing poster, right? That is just a wonderful image, which really, in a way, the show didn't have to include. It wasn't totally necessary to the narrative or even necessarily the tone or the theme to have that particular thing, but there's such a liveliness to it in that way. It feels like this little discovery. We've already seen the poster, we've already seen the boss, we've already seen the space, but Lynch is kind of finding these new ways to have fun with it. And of course, Tom Sizemore ruminates in the office with you know, something very portentous going on there. Yeah, and then also I just need to mention the whole clapper bit is really lovely.
Oh my god. All the parts with Sunny. Well, first of all, I love the very gentle gesture of like taking a Miss Vicky's chip and putting it on his on Sunny Jim's comforter, mm-hmm. and just leaving it there for him. Good, like I mean, I sound like I don't know. Is it possible to sound strange when talking about Lynch? Why not? But like the emphasis again on like these inner like children and like how, you know, sort of like joyful they are, because the clapper part is just like, you know, he's basically you know, again, he's like undergone this trauma. He like can't express himself like a normal human being, a normal adult human being. And yet they have this moment together that's like very playful and wonderful, and then he just leaves the entire bag of chips on the comforter, and Sunny Jim doesn't put them anywhere. He just keeps them on top of his sheets and goes to sleep. Like, I just love, it's a very gentle gesture. But then I don't know, to sort of go back to all the great things Michelle Chion has written about the original series, you know, like just the amount of time that's dedicated to like the sound of chewing. And like the fact that it's they're crunchy sandwiches and then crunchy chips, and we have to sort of sit there with them and listen to them chewing, in old man time. It's fine.
Kind of mirroring the green tea sequence from the last episode.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, we should mention this is the first episode too without Alpha Coop, which kind of gives it a whole different feel to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I missed Alpha Coop, honestly. I mean, I love that whole role, but also the place in which he's been put is intriguing me endlessly. I think in part because I the place where I went to go view it had the previous episode on beforehand, and I had sort of forgotten about, you know, Mr. Strawberry and the cow jumped over the moon, and my curiosity about that. That's kind of the one corner of the show so far where I think my curiosity to know overrides sort of the pleasure in just taking it in that way. So, yeah, I wouldn't call it impatience necessarily. We can go an hour without Alpha Coop, but I am looking forward to getting back to him. One question I have for the both of you. First, I had brought this up to several people with whom I viewed this, and they all said no, so perhaps you'll say no too. But was there something kind of odd going on with the camera operation in this episode? Because as I was watching it, I sort of noticed that there were these sort of vibrations in the image at particular moments. What would ostensibly be just a static shot of somebody talking, the camera would slightly lift. I mean, it would lift maybe like half an inch during a shot. Was anybody else taking note of this? Or it was kind of driving me a little nuts after a while.
The only handheld I noticed was in the Hitman sequence near the end, but no. And I watched the episode twice, so.
Okay.
Is this, do you detect the influence of Lav Diaz on this episode? I'll be honest, I didn't really notice that either, but.
Okay. Yeah, it was. I mean, I'm certainly not suggesting it's a clue to the series or anything. It was just a little thing.
We're going to name drop all the slow cinema masters throughout the entirety of this podcast.
Soon enough. Yes. No, but I don't know. That was a small thing. Yes, but the Hitman sequence. What was going on with the rap song, by the way? I don't understand that at all. I honestly was wondering if I was going a little nuts and I was just hearing this in my head, because it. It's almost remarkably out of place. I was kind of shocked by that. And it also plays over what is, I think there's something about the song, kind of the bounciness of it, that has a certain cutesy, fun quality. It's playing over just a really horrific scene. I mean, it's kind of him in full Wild at Heart mode, which I don't think he's quite gone to so far in this show. But yeah, what did you guys make of the rap song that plays over the dwarf?
I didn't necessarily find it quite an ironic juxtaposition. I just found it again. Like, I almost say it's funny because, I mean, I guess you could say David Lynch's taste in music is, you know, extremely white. So it was kind of interesting to hear, like, even though I know he's a fan of Kanye, we should know. It was interesting actually hearing probably what's the first hip hop beat, I guess, other than A Real Indication from Firewalk with Me. In the Twin Peaks oeuvre. So I didn't necessarily take it as kind of the, you know, Tarantino era kind of ironic juxtaposition, stuck in the middle with you kind of thing. But I agree, when he opened up and he found the letter and that beat hit, that was like a, whoa, that DMX feeling kind of.
Right.
Well, what I'll say is that the thing that I found refreshing about this new series is that, as you know, if you look at us, it's something like Breaking Bad. When is the only time that you hear hip hop or music by Black or Latino artists? It's when a crime is happening, right? And I feel like that really reinforces something entrenched and very white and very negative. And here, whenever there's a bad person who are very clearly bad people, you hear heavy metal. It's this very, it's a very different coding of, and like the music is always way too loud, right? And so I find that refreshing, where it's like this beat isn't necessarily, this particular song is connected to a very particular character. And every time we see her, literally, even if it's just a photograph, we hear this, right? And so I also didn't view it as like an ironic counterpoint. And it's just like, you know, for me, it was more, this is just, I almost feel like it's more of a commentary on contemporary America, where people do just sort of like blast music really loud. And they always play the same song over and over and over again. And, I don't know. I think that throughout this episode in particular, again, because it's less about the mystery of, you know, Dougie and Bad Coop, blah, 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 that you really get a sense of how acutely attuned David Lynch is to contemporary malaise. You know, we see, you know, Harry Dean Stanton's neighbor who hitches a ride with him into town, you know, he's getting screwed over, his girlfriend's getting screwed over by the VA, right? Mm-hmm. He's not happy about the war. You know, Sheriff Truman's son also kind of fucked over by the war. These people mm-hmm. who are just kind of doing these, you know, or even, you know, Dougie's wife's big speech to the guys who are shaking, you know, that have, you're taking the money, right? You know, these are just like, you know, we're barely making it as it is. Like, we're working people, like, how dare you do this? And just, like, tapping into this, to, like, I mean, even though this film, you know, obviously, so much of the original, like, so much of what happened in the original series, like, the idea that someone could just work at a diner and survive as an adult is becoming increasingly less feasible, to have like a sort of a middle class or even like a lower middle class existence as a waitress on the salary of a waitress is not possible. And so like introducing these other things into it, I feel like is addressing these like new economic realities in the way that a lot of other shows don't or just gloss over. And so I find it just completely fascinating. So,
well, do we want to maybe incorporate, do we think Mark Frost's politics are playing into this at all? I mean, I don't know if we want to get into that too deeply, but because I always imagine Frost, the kind of guy who wears like a America Never Stopped Being Great hat.
I mean, I feel like David, because again, Lynch is so tapped into TM. And so that, I think that manifests itself in the fact that he is very anti-war. Specifically against the wars that have been going on since, you know, for 16, 15 years now. But then also the fact that the Maharishi Institute, Maharishi U, is in Fairfield, Iowa, which is the most basic sort of, you know, it's like everyday Midwestern people. And, you know, he has spent time there. And so he has been exposed to like the concerns of, you know, kind of everyday Americans in a way that he would not be in Los Angeles. And so I feel like, and also, I mean, even like the work, you know, the documentary that his son did last year is very much tapped into like, what does the working class look like right now? What does that even mean? What sort of fucking problems do they have? Where do they live? What sort of like, offices, workspaces, homes do they occupy? Like, it's clearly, I feel like he's tapped into it and interested in it in a way that not like a mainstream network television people are just not.
If I remember correctly, Lynch was a Bernie bro, right?
Yes. I was so happy about that.
Have either of you read the political views section of David Lynch's Wikipedia page, perchance?
No, I do know he avidly voted for Reagan in 84. Other than that, I'm not too...
If it doesn't bring things to a halt too much, I would like to read part of it.
Sure.
Just because I think it is... Actually, I think in the context of this, is actually worth sharing. Well, past the Reagan thing, it says, describing his political philosophy, he stated, "At that time, I thought of myself as a libertarian. I believed in next to zero government, and I still would lean toward no government and not so many rules, except for traffic lights and things like this. I really believe in traffic regulations." And he says, "I don't know if there's ever even a Libertarian Party. They wouldn't have a prayer of getting anywhere. So I'm a Democrat now, and I've always been a Democrat, really, but I don't like the Democrats a lot either. Because I'm a smoker, and I think a lot of the Democrats have come up with these rules for non-smoking." So
that's exactly what I would expect him to say, honestly.
Yeah.
Because, like, and again, like, even, like, what, you know, the character of Dr. Amp, which was, like, another kind of, like, yell out loud moment for me, because I love the great performance artist Alex Jones. Or I'm fascinated by him. I would not say I'm an adherent of his philosophy, but I'm fascinated by the way in which he sort of seduces people in, and like the completely, you know, the fact that when he, how he sort of gets people in is exactly what Dr. Amp does, right? Where he's sort of, it's this very nebulous idea of them. Maybe them is the government. Maybe them is the Illuminati, lizard people, Jews, whatever. But the idea that there's a them and that they're not letting you live the way your life is supposed to be. And tapping into that sense of like, something about this is wrong. And obviously me as a leftist, I would say, well, that problem is like capitalism. There's, you know, everything's run fucking amok. But at that very basic level, people from very different political parts of the political spectrum can come together and be like, yeah, things are not the way they should be. There are a lot of wrong things about the world. And here, you know, people, the characters we see in this episode in particular are complaining specifically about the government. And I think that, again, I think Lynch was definitely tapping into something that people all over this country were clearly feeling, so, and still do feel.
You're saying that. I like this, the recent episodes, this conflation of low lives in corporate America in that way.
Yeah.
Because you have the two guys who are trying to get the money, one of whom is played by Jeremy Davies. The fact that Lynch and Jeremy Davies haven't collaborated thus far, haven't collaborated until now, is honestly kind of shocking to me. But you have this whole spiel that Naomi Watts goes on about this as being a cruel world and you are part of the problem. But then I immediately flash back to early in the previous episode when Tom Sizemore is lying about the regulations that they were enforcing or something like that, that kind of that high and low, and you know, there perhaps isn't such a difference between them. I'm liking the way he's drawing that and kind of the increasing sense of danger that I'm feeling in that corporate environment, honestly, which is not really anything new for Lynch. I mean, I most readily think of Mulholland Drive, which positions Hollywood, even in sort of a dream version, as this place of, you know, like these freakish looking people doing these backroom deals and these channels of power. But nevertheless, kind of the, not only the thing with Sizemore, but also whatever the hell is going on with the documents, where he's drawing what is ostensibly gibberish, and yet it is creating these very disturbing connections that only a few people can understand, combined with, again, whatever the hell's going on with the hit men who have been assigned to look after Dougie to take him down. Him drawing those lines is very fascinating to me, and it doesn't, I don't know, it feels kind of, it feels new for him in a way, that particular connection. I don't know if either of you can think of times when it's really clearly drawn, because obviously the whole evil lurking underneath the surface is a very Lynchian concept, but the way it's being brought to the fore here, I'm particularly compelled by.
Well, I was going to say, for me, the drawings are, you know, you could see it the way that you've described it, or you could just see it as that, you know, corporate America, you know, he's an insurance claims investor, right? That, you know, this very, this industry that's sort of designed to find ways not to pay somebody who's had a terrible accident, right? And the idea that he can just go in and with these little points of light, draw these scribbles that don't, you know, maybe he was just drawing. He was just literally just scribbling and drawing this repeated pattern that he saw. And that, because corporate America itself makes no sense within that context, it's like, oh my God, this amazing pattern. Like, it's just this total like kismet happenstance sort of thing. Because again, the world, like the rules that they're trying to enforce don't make any sense. That the fact that they have this giant building with a guy with pointing a gun outside of it, or like a ranger of some kind, that doesn't make any sense. Like nothing, you know, everything about this world is sort of flawed and doesn't make any sense.
Well, I mean, in terms of not making sense, do we want to talk about the Richard Horn red scene involving two returning new characters?
Yes.
I don't quite know what to make of Balthazar Getty's character, because, I mean, we talked about this on our episode zero. Nick brought this up about how Getty just has this very kind of worn out, kind of sleazy look to him, which is, you know, well exploited in this episode. But, I mean, there's hinting even, there may even be more to this character, unless we can deduce that it's under an altered state.
Well, perhaps. I mean, what was going on with the dime suspended in the air and then somehow transported into Richard Horne's mouth? I can't quite make sense of, except that it kind of, in a weird way, people are already drawing comparisons between Balthazar Getty in this and Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet, and it kind of reminded me of the very sudden cut or the disappearance after he shouts, "I'll fuck any," yeah, after he says, "I'll fuck anything that moves," and then it's the sound of the car revving and he's gone. It sort of made me think of that, where there is something perhaps kind of otherworldly about this character, or he is in communion with something that's going on in the town of Twin Peaks, but I don't know. I'm not going to claim a total understanding here.
Some weeks it's just okay to say it's a good scene.
Or, I mean, I think, rewatching it, something that I keep coming back to is that, the moment when, Cooper leaves the Black Lodge and Bad Cooper is on the highway driving. That's very much like Lost Highway, more than anything else. And I feel like the Balthazar Getty character is maybe more like Robert Blake's Mystery Man, where it's like he's so bad that he can sort of bend time and space, and that, you know, he really did make the quarter or the dime spin in the air for that long, because that's what he can do, because he's so, you know, maybe he has some sort of connection to the Black Lodge, or he has some connection to, you know, Bad Cooper, blah blah blah. It just feels like that wasn't something drug induced. That was supposed to be a very literal demonstration of this guy's power, which is why, you know, Mr. Horne is so upset, so flustered by it, and needs to assert his own power in the world, and ends up killing a child.
Well, what's to bring up Richard Horne is that obviously he seems so far in the show the most despicable character, yet at the same time, we see him in a very kind of weak, trembling state in both his scenes, both kind of witnessing this and in the car. That truck sequence could not even cut inside the truck after he ran over the child, but it cuts back to him showing this remorse of sorts. Not enough remorse, really, but still. I mean, people have been speculating about this character, if he's going to be Audrey soon or Jerry soon or Benson or whatever, but I think we'll get a complicated portrayal of evil with this character, at least.
No, perhaps. I mean, he is kind of cartoonishly bad at this point.
Villains are. They all are. They're terrifying. Until they do something that, like, you know, he's towing on the edge of the absurd, and then he just yanks it in this completely other direction where you're, like, scared shitless.
Sure, sure. Although I suppose I find, for instance, Alpha Coop a little more immediately compelling. Granted, there's so much history with the character and the actor playing him, but the Richard Horne thing so far, I think part of it is that actor just looks unbelievably evil. I mean, he kind of looks like a romantic painting of Satan or something. I mean, that's kind of, and I'm not necessarily complaining either, because I find that fascinating, because he also has a certain 50s face to him, I think, too. There is something about the angularity of his face that wouldn't necessarily be out of place in, like, the background of a Nicholas Ray movie or something. It's just happens to be in this case. I'm curious, how exactly this character is going to evolve, because, as Ethan said, I was compelled by the hints of remorse, sort of the self-justification for plowing over this child and not even taking a second to stop. And it's also one of those things, too, where watching this, I'm having the weird experience of a scene will play out, and I have no idea if it will really come back at a later point. And I even felt that way about a child being run over by what is ostensibly going to be a main character. Watching it, I sort of was, yeah, I mean, I was wondering how exactly they could come back to that in a way, but I'm not too worried about that either. But yeah, that's just part of the whole experience of watching it and asking myself, how are these pieces going to connect if they do connect at all? But I suppose who cares?
Focus on the donut, or the donut, not the hole.
Exactly.
Yes, of course, of course, of course.
I guess we should actually bring up the Hawk finding what may have been pages of Laura Palmer's diary scene.
Oh, yeah. What in the hell was going on there? Where the coin was...
Because he found another Indian.
Right. But yeah, still, that was...
It's so bizarre. I mean, it's like, of course, like, it's like that classic, like, the unified field where it's like one thing leads you to look at another thing, leads you to the thing you were looking for the entire time. Like, uh-huh. I just hate Chuck so much. I hate that guy so much.
Chad. The thing is, I feel like I have to get the name right because he just looks like a shitty Chad.
He's a total Chad, right?
Yeah.
The only way he could be more Chad is if his name was like Chet, but because I guess he's a millennial, he's Chad. Fuck that guy forever.
Yeah, I sort of suspect we're gonna see a pretty grisly end for that guy based on sort of how these characters fare in Twin Peaks generally, and I will enjoy it greatly.
It's nice to see a cop depicted as a shitty person in this universe for once.
Yes, exactly. That too. Or just generally, it's like, he's not like a crooked cop. He's just super fucking petty and unpleasant to be around. And even his coworkers do not like him. And I'm like, that's, again, not something you see cops depicted as every day. Enjoyed it. But the discovery, I think it was like, given how sort of low key the entire episode was, again, sort of putting the mystery on the back burner, it was tantalizing in a way that was like, it made me like, I mean, I'm always ready for more of the show. And I think, but this was like a really nice tantalizing bit because what could it be?
Pages of Laura Palmer's diary.
No, something else.
You know, I initially thought, and again, speculation, but there is, as I think the two of you ardent Twin Peaks fans will know, it was planned that in season 3, back when, you know, Bill Clinton was running for president, thank you, Ethan, that they would find pages of Laura's diary, and it would be the... What would it be exactly? Would it be the communication that Annie had made to her about the good deal being in the lodge or something along those lines? And that it would lead to sort of this rescue mission for Dale Cooper. And I wonder if that's exactly what we're getting here. It was the first thing that came to mind, if nothing else. And that seems plenty plausible to me. And it is funny how they can bring that back, albeit in this much more inexplicable way than it probably would have been handled on ABC in 1991 or so, where it just happens to be in the door of the bathroom, in the men's bathroom of the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department. And I am so hoping we never get any explanation as to why the hell those pages are being hidden there. Watching
maybe,
it.
Maybe it's just like Andy's love sonnets he wrote while sitting on the can.
God, Jesus! While he was making the sperm that created Wally Brando.
Yes.
Sorry.
Because as you'll remember, the only two people who see Cooper come out of the Black Lodge are Harry S. Truman and Andy. So.
Oh.
It really could be. I feel like it's not necessarily because it's. I think if you look at the paper, it's not the size of a diary. It's like folded up I think it might be something else. But again, this is absolutely the kind of speculation I do not enjoy engaging in.
Yeah. No. I know. Yes.
Well, I mean, do we have any concluding thoughts?
I continue, like most people, to just be infatuated with the chemistry that David Lynch and Naomi Watts clearly have. It is something very special. It is a very precise manifestation of Lynch's sensibilities as a writer. And it's I've noticed in sort of the reactions to it that a lot of us, I think, are kind of forgetting just how well they work together, because really our only example is one film from now 16 years ago. But all of the things she's kind of bringing to that role, the certain exasperation where it is sort of believable that her husband has always been like this, even though I still question what was this guy like in real life, where people aren't immediately freaked out by how he's behaving now.
I mean, if I would speculate, I would say that he could just be someone who was kind of didn't give a shit about his family, and that's why he put them in this really hard jam. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody who just sort of punches the clock, you know, supports the family, goes home, barely speaks to them, and then spends recreational time with prostitutes.
Right.
You know, because to sort of like let off steam, because the idea that somebody, if they owe a ton of money to like loan sharks, would go and like just hang out with a prostitute, mm-hmm. not responsible, kind of just shows that, yeah, like kind of past the point of giving a fuck. And maybe that's why Sonny Jim is so excited by this new half-mute version of his dad, because at least he gives a shit.
Oh, no, definitely. I think it's, for me, it's the very brief glimpse we got at Dougie Jones as he exists in the real world, where he just seems more like a schmucky guy than anything else, and not, you know, not without a brain in his head, like almost literally without a brain in his head, where he's, you know, just his coworkers don't seem entirely alarmed. I mean, you know, personally, if one of my coworkers were to start acting like him, I would call, you know, an ambulance right away. And, you know, obviously on a less literal level, I do love it as his corporate parody that you can basically be brain dead and just get by in this world. And yep. I am loving it in that way. Yes. But anyway, Naomi Watts' presence is very welcome. I am finding her a good fit for the world of Twin Peaks, even if this is not literally in Twin Peaks.
I was going to bring up about Naomi Watts and David Lynch. So in Rabbits, did she just do a voice, or did she put on that actual bunny costume?
I think she just did a voice.
Okay, because she put on the costume. That is dedication to David Lynch.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a nice thought, at least.
Well, Violet, thank you for joining us. And where can we find you on the internet?
Well, I'm on Twitter as @unbuttonmyeyes. I chose that handle a long time ago. I can't change it. I'm also at Film Comment and on the Film Comment podcast. So please listen. Please rate and subscribe. Mm. And push down the negative reviews from old clunky print subscribers. I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I have been a longtime fan of the Film Comment podcast. You talk about serious subjects with some of the most august, distinguished critical voices of our time. And now here you are with us. So.
And I wholly enjoyed when you made one of your co-hosts watch Jane Silent Bob Strike Back.
She didn't know who they were. I had to let her know. Yeah, hopefully I didn't rant too much about David Lynch incoherently.
No. I pleasure listening to you, truly.
Yeah, thank you again for stooping to our level. And Nick, of course, as always, thank you. And keep listening until early September.
show.